Her career included outpatient primary care, inpatient medicine, and palliative care, but Jen is best known for her expertise and passion for improving the care of patients with substance use disorders. Jen, welcome to Inspired to Heal, and great to have you on the show.
Hi, Phil. I'm glad to be here.
What or who inspired you to become a physician?
To be honest, I kind of walked into it backwards. I really didn't have much of an idea about what it would mean to be a doctor. I worked at a nursing home as a nurse's aide when I was in high school. That was my high school job once I turned 16. I'll say that was because there was really only a few jobs that were available in my smallish town that I could access without a car. So that was my exposure to being in a quote-unquote healthcare environment. And my main takeaway from that is, man, I could do this so much better. That was my teenage arrogance. But also, it was my introduction to how this wasn't an awful nursing home. This was a nice nursing home, but how always I think things can be done a little bit better and certainly at that time could be more patient-centered. So I had that exposure, but really, when I was applying to colleges, I applied to a program at Brown University where you could go to college with them. And then as a senior in high school, they were accepting you also that as long as you didn't flunk out of Brown College, they put you in Brown Medical School, which I always thought was kind of a free ride. And I hadn't gone through that fire of ambition and that maybe I didn't deserve to be where I was, or that it meant that I wasn't really cut out for it. But it turned out to be a blessing. I wouldn't have wanted any other job.
And did you ever feel like you wanted to go back to nursing home care as a physician and improve things?
I don't think there was a term geriatric medicine back then, but no, then life takes you in many different directions, right? I became very disillusioned while I was in medical school, particularly when I hit the clinical years. I was astounded by what I saw as an arrogance, particularly of the physician staff. And what I didn't really think was very focused on caring about patients. In that disillusionment, I found the VA health system, which was also part of my medical school experience. And when I got to the VA, I felt a lot more comfortable about how the staff in general, and specifically the attending staff, really seemed to orient themselves towards delivering care or participating in the care of people who needed it. I realized that I could be really happy in the publicly funded health system. Another big part of this is that working in a publicly funded situation, patients have a different orientation towards who you are and what you may or may not give them. And a probably unhealthy amount of gratitude for what they did receive, which I always felt very honored to be given the responsibility of providing care to people who didn't have a lot of other choices about where they could get their care. And feeling it was very important to be respectful and also to make as careful a decision as possible.
Did you see that change over your time at Cook County?
I think the overall orientation of the professional staff at the county always was very patient-centered and mission-driven. I fluctuated over time, honestly, in terms of how I felt about how much balance there was between patting oneself on the back for doing good and genuinely being most concerned about whether one did good by the patient.
Yeah.
So sometimes there would be, I think, a little bit of self-congratulation, but more often not. More often frustration and concern that one didn't do a good enough job.
Tell me about medicine at that time that you came to Cook County. What was different then compared to today?
This was the latter half of the 1980s. The big thing in medicine and primary care was HIV. This was a time when we were just beginning to grapple with being able to identify HIV among the people that we suspected might have HIV. So when I was a resident, which was in a public hospital in New York City, as residents, we had to bring the trays into our patients because the dietary people didn't want to enter a room of people that they thought might have HIV. Not very courageous or exemplary behavior on a part of a lot of people working in healthcare organizations. But I did not find that true at County by the time I arrived there. HIV was just such a blanket over everything because, of course, we didn't really have very good treatments. Offering to test someone for HIV involved a pretty complex protocol of counseling people about how they would feel about the news if it turned out they were positive, who their support would be, so people could think ahead about how to prepare for a potentially positive test. Because basically at that time, it was a death sentence, pretty much. Also, the late 80s was the crack crisis in the United States. It was also a time of a huge amount of injection drug use. I had done my training in Harlem Hospital, which in the middle of northern Manhattan, the complications of injection drug use were a large part of what we care for in inpatient medical service. This is Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs time period. So there wasn't a lot of empathy for people who were substance users. And in fact, there was a lot of stigma. There was a lot of politics that went into the description of the cocaine epidemic, which was the crack epidemic, and the describing of crack babies, the differentiation between powdered cocaine and crack cocaine, which even went into the judicial system and was really driven by racism, frankly. There's always been a tight association between substance use and racism. The labeling of othered people. This could be really early on in like in the 1800s, the Chinese and opium. And then the black population and marijuana. And so crack meant black. So the stigma that already existed regarding substance abuse, which was even true for alcohol, alcoholics brought that on themselves. They were weak. It was a moral failing. That was just amplified for drug users, and in particular, people of color. It was targeted at them. The first job I had at County was at a clinic that was in the basement of a Salvation Army. This was a joint clinical effort by the Cook County Hospital and the Salvation Army, that the county would provide the professional staff and the Salvation Army provided the space for this clinic that did primary care largely for the population of the west side of Chicago, which at the time was where a lot of the homeless population of the city stayed and where there were a number of not-for-profit funded substance use treatment programs. This clinic served those populations primarily. I mean, I had some elderly women and gentlemen who lived in the senior buildings that was not too far from the clinic, but 80% of my patients were people who were either actively engaged in use in their addiction or in early recovery. So those factors that I say were salient in medicine in general were, like in this clinic, were particularly what framed my early experience as a young doctor.
Were you aware, or did you notice a funneling of patients to Cook County who may have been considered as undesirable from other health systems? And yeah, I guess that was a pretty obvious question.
Well, I mean, you know that a paper that made the New England Journal of Medicine describing the dumping of patients from primarily the emergency room at Rush to the Cook County Hospital building and the wallet triaging of patients from the Rush to the county ED, which was literally a block away.
Yeah. And I think it was insurance, but it might also, I imagine some of the HIV AIDS patients.
Oh, absolutely.
Were insured,
absolutely.
But maybe lost their insurance.
Yeah. Right. By the early 90s, I also participated in a women and children's HIV clinic. For sure, patients actually, some of them with insurance, self-chose to come to that clinic to avoid the stigma that they felt or the shunning that they might feel at another institution. And they felt safer or less judged. And I also saw that around HIV when I was a resident in Harlem. We had patients not too infrequently who were concerned that they had HIV. They had a lifestyle that would label them to have HIV. Just had that lifestyle and then were seeking care that might be related to it and would come to Harlem because they were concerned about how they would be judged and treated elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the Black community, that's always been a big concern. Is how, even if I'm allowed care at this entity, will I actually receive the care that I'm going to need? Or will the prejudice in this organization keep me from getting what I need? The Black community in Cook County, for sure, saw county as a place where you would get the care that you needed.
It struck me in my clinical time that patients would be very upfront about their drug use or behaviors that would not be considered socially acceptable and they might try to suppress. Maybe it had to do with the trust that they felt when they came to Cook County.
Yeah, for sure. Once I started doing palliative care, I also saw this among patients with cancer. Patients had received a cancer diagnosis somewhere else and then chose to come to county to get a second opinion and then their care because they trusted that they would get what they should get. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, great for county, but it's terrible. What an indictment of our health organizations in our city. So access turns out to have so many more dimensions than just literally, do you have a wallet for it?
One of the physicians and researchers who I worked with did research on the trust of the patients at Cook County. And one of the poignant examples of this was when the question was asked of the person why they would come to Cook County. And they said, well, Cook County treats me like a number, which would be something that a lot of people would think that's an indictment of the care, that you're treated like a number. But this means I'm treated the same as anybody else. Nobody has privileges above me because of their social standing. And being treated like a number was something they considered complimentary of the system.
Right. Which doesn't mean we always did a good job or treated people with the respect that they deserved. The other thing that was different about the county when I first started working at county was that the patronage system that was part of all county-funded government entities, when I first started working for county, it was still ripe. A lot of the non-professional staff were just patronage hires and like, I don't really have to do this if I don't want to kind of an attitude. That changed over time as there was less and less patronage in the hiring.
Where you brought expertise to the health system was the treatment of substance use disorders.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started there, that was you had just received a large grant and I joined you in the kickoff meeting.
Yeah.
And at that meeting, you said, this is kind of like when I was a cross-country runner in high school. We'd come to a hill, the challenge was difficult, but I focused on one step at a time. I don't know if you remember that or how you feel about it, or if you felt like you reached the peak or you just never quite made it up the hill.
Okay, so cutting to the chase, the last part of that question.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what, it's always one step at a time. If something really big happens, that's what it looks like. Then it's just, you don't see all of the little steps that came before. Yeah.
What made you decide to focus on substance use, or what was the motivation that you felt like we needed to improve our care?
I had been taught relatively little in medical school and virtually nothing during my residency about addiction, although I knew a lot about caring for the medical complications of people with addiction disorders. But I really didn't know a lot about addiction per se. And so while I was at the Freedom Center Clinic, I started going to 12-step meetings. I was just really overwhelmed by the personal stories of, and then the courageousness of the people who I was caring for, who were dealing with their addiction disorders. I had never encountered people who, to me, seemed so demonstrating the human spirit to overcome. And I was just in awe. And I was like, God, this is really remarkable. Also, it is incredibly remarkable to see someone enter recovery and do well, which does happen with appropriate treatment when people have an addiction disorder. So see sort of the before and after, and not that like people don't have relapses, and but to see where people are coming from, and then as they begin to have positive experiences, how they reclaim parts of their lives and their relationships is really pretty dramatic. That's like when you see somebody who has sepsis and you give them antibiotics and then they perk up and the next day you can't believe it. You're looking at the same person. Yeah. Well, it doesn't happen quite as fast as that. It's not quite as easy as that, as giving somebody antibiotics. But it's just, I like, oh my God, oh my God. So I was really highly motivated and then really frustrated.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I thought HIV and AIDS was going to have its unintended consequence for making awareness and therefore the desire to do better by addiction disorders because of the relationship between HIV and substance use. All this money pouring into and attention pouring into HIV care and AIDS care. I thought, this is going to be the beginning of a new era for addiction treatment. But nah. Not so much. It really didn't do much, I don't think, in the overall community thinking about, meaning the larger community thinking about addiction disorders. Our cultural view of addiction disorders didn't really change very much, I don't think. Not in the way that we've then seen with the quote-unquote opioid epidemic. That has made some difference in terms of generally the stigma that is assigned to addiction disorders because of the implication of big pharma, and that people got addicted through their being given medication by a medical provider, and then that's how they got hooked. It has fallen to communities where I can people didn't expect that it was going to happen to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the issues that I felt that you were trying to get accomplished was viewing the treatment of addiction as a chronic disease that we as physicians should be able to treat in our health system and not have to rely on specialized centers. Do you still think that would be an important direction for the country to go, is to integrate that treatment into health systems?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah, certainly, yes, huge elements of it should be part of regular medical care. And I think maybe there are a little bit more now than they were. I mean, I really do think there's been some change. When I first started in the Division of General Medicine, I was kind of assigned a mentor who was a senior physician in the division. He asked me what I was interested in. And I said, I really want to work on substance use disorders. I really want to see, blah, blah, blah. I had some things I wanted to do. And he looked at me and said, well, isn't that really a social worker job? He didn't want to talk to me about it. The idea of screening for substance use disorders within the context of regular health care wasn't really high on the agenda. And it wasn't really, and it's like, well, if we do, what are we going to do about it anyway? That was the, I can ask these questions. But even if I do, well, there's nothing out there to do anything about it. So why would I dig this up? So that was sort of the attitude.
Not true.
For sure. For decades before this, a much smaller group of people had been trying to bring screening into regular medical care. I mean, I remember a lecture I had in medical school that included teaching us the CAGE mnemonic, which was a series of four questions to screen somebody for alcohol problems.
Mm-hmm.
That hardly took off. It took decades and decades. I think I have a better perspective on this now because I guess I understand how the pharmaceutical companies had something to do with this, but I was astounded that incorporating pain as the fifth vital sign happened as quickly and as thoroughly as it did, when basic questions about even just alcohol use were not similarly incorporated.
And that pain as the fifth vital sign ended up doing a lot of harm.
Right. And now we know that it was not a coincidence that those were associated, which is just, you know, it's sad. I was able to get a series of grants over time to build residency training programs to teach about alcohol and other drugs and what's the responsibility of a regular medical provider, not a specialty addictions provider. What's the responsibilities? What can you do? When I would go to a national conference for people who were interested in addiction medicine, a huge percentage would be in the addictions field, brought there through either their own addiction or the addiction of someone close to them. Mm-hmm. But over time, I've seen more and more young professionals entering their careers with either a focus on addiction medicine or a side interest in addiction medicine, that are just in it because it's intellectually stimulating, personally challenging, as any topic might be, but not because of their own personal tragedy. That is very encouraging. It just speaks to getting more mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that broader acceptance of it as part of the health system and your right. preliminary work, I want to just acknowledge that it's lived on and it has been taken over by someone who's equally passionate and driven. And it's now common that the health system and the jail integrate their work.
I know.
We have providers in most, if not all, of the ambulatory clinics who were willing to prescribe medications and treatment. And we have a walk-in clinic so people can come in and get treatment as soon as they leave the hospital without that delay that frustrated us in the grant and that caused the majority of people not be able to make their methadone clinic appointments.
Right. As part of the grant you and I worked on, at one point because we had the funding for it, we had a relationship with methadone providers in the community where we were identifying people in the hospital and referring them directly from their discharge into methadone maintenance. Hugely successful. Hugely successful. But it only worked as long as there was the money to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And then, as you know now, although there is terrific younger leadership of treatment for addictions in the health system now, they execute their work largely through grant funding. So it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back, a little bit at a time.
I would say two steps forward and one step back.
Yeah.
Or maybe three or four steps.
Okay. But that's just to say that it's just never ending. It just, you know, you just have to stay focused. You can't stop, which can get really tiring, but you can't stop. You have to keep going. You cannot lose focus. It will go away.
Yeah. My son, who is working in a naloxone distribution program in Washington, D.C., and his question, hospitals and health systems focus on treatment. And where is the role of harm reduction in health systems? Should we be moving in that direction? And it might help for some of the listeners to describe what is meant by harm reduction.
Largely, it's a approach that says one meets people where they're at. The clinician's responsibility is to learn their goals, their thoughts, and then the clinician with their own knowledge of healthcare implications to guide that individual to steps that might fit with their goals at the time and improve their health outcomes. It might be a baby step, like for an injection drug user using clean paraphernalia. I think that would probably be one of the most commonly understood harm reduction.
Mm-hmm. Like a needle exchange.
Like a needle exchange. So it might be learning from someone about what their drinking pattern is and talking with them about what some of the consequences of that use might be, if they have any concerns about that. And then if so, problem solving with them how they might modify those consequences. Mm-hmm. So the grant that you and I were on was actually early intervention within healthcare setting. It was really primarily motivated by the data on alcohol use in the United States and the realization there were a huge number of people that were having meaningful medical complications from their alcohol use, even though they weren't actually addicted users. They were just heavy users because it was culturally acceptable and appropriate to use as they did, to drink as they did. That whole grant, the whole thing was harm reduction. It was really targeted at trying to decrease the harm from heavy alcohol use by getting clinicians to learn if their patients were drinking what would be considered medically heavy, meaning they might not have behavioral consequences, social consequences from their drinking, but they could have medical consequences, like in terms of their liver or their heart or their likelihood of cancer, and that if they would cut back, those potential risks would be modified. For other people who have addiction disorder, of course, it's a lot more complex than that, because cutting back is not an easy behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Within the context of like primary care, there's so much you can do in terms of educating people if you learn about what it is they're doing. But that's the big if, is you have to first learn what people are doing in terms of consumption of their use, whether they're using some kind of drug or whether they're using alcohol, and then raising those health harms to the person, and then discussing, well, is there anything you feel at this point you would want to try and change?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a harm reduction approach.
Mm-hmm. I was always impressed that the Division of General Medicine, so people who had not specialized into other areas, mm-hmm. were primary care physicians, seemed to be a wellspring of innovation for the health system. And I can think of many programs, a lot of whom I will be interviewing and describe in other episodes. How did that happen, that general medicine was driving so much innovation in our health system?
I want to say that, first of all, it's important to realize that numerically, at least within the Department of Medicine, we were the biggest, we're a huge division. I mean, at most, we're like 30-some physicians. I don't know how many cardiologists there are, but they're not that many. So first of all, we're just numerically a lot of us. And I think, but, you know, I learned once I was division chief and was meeting with other division chiefs of general medicine across the country, I learned that it was not uncommon for divisions of general medicine to be the source or the site of people with certain academic interests that would want to do research or programmatic change, like what happened in our division. I think as a general internist, and you're a general internist, Bill, you're mm-hmm. sort of positioned to have a perspective across the health continuum and the healthcare continuum, because you interact with all of the components of it. I mean, when you and I started in general internal medicine, we were clinic and hospital based. There wasn't the division of the hospitalists and the outpatient people.
Mm-hmm.
We did both. So we were in the hospital, we were outside of the hospital. A lot of our specialist colleagues didn't have that much exposure to people in an ambulatory context. Yes, they took care of their specific medical issues in an ambulatory context, but it wasn't the whole person. Mm-hmm. And I think that just lends itself to taking a bigger look and being interested then as a professional in the system of care.
Mm-hmm.
And that drove a lot of the innovative stuff that you saw. Like, for example, HIV care came out of general medicine.
I think that ability to make changes in the system was probably very important in prevention of burnout, which is pretty common among primary care physicians. But being able to recognize a problem and make changes, I would think adds to satisfaction.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head there. And I think that's how a lot of people in our division of general medicine sustain themselves, was mm-hmm. by having their own little project, whether it was big or small, that kept them intellectually stimulated, interested, whether it was maybe developing a component of an education program for the residents or medical students, or whether it was care delivery related, you know, making some small change at their clinic in terms of how the clinic operated to manage a certain problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't take long as a clinician to recognize treating a person one by one can be frustrating, and recognizing we have to change some structures or systems or policies to improve this on a more population level. And I think general right. internists kind of see right. advantages in population health.
Right. Yes. And you're there to see the sort of beginning and end of a lot of things, including people's lives, right? So like literally, you see your patients over time and you just have an awareness of how care delivery affects that continuum. Yeah.
One of the things that Kathy Diamant said was important for the palliative care service and preventing burnout was getting together and doing a reading or reading a poem together and discussing it and how that impacts them and their work. And one in particular was The Lamb and the Pine Cone. Do you remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have a
Pablo
similar
Neruda?
Yeah. And did that, do you feel like that also could carry over to the substance use work, that there were gifts that you received from patients, maybe not material gifts, but gifts that you received in terms of their outcomes?
You know, I always felt that way about all my patients. I took so seriously my responsibility that I was not necessarily their first choice because of their circumstances, you know, in terms of being their healthcare provider. So it was always a gift to me that they accepted my care. As I spoke earlier about people with addictions disorders, providing them care was particularly meaningful to me. Even if the only difference that I made is that I treated them with respect and dignity, that itself often was so meaningful to them, it hurt my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So many times somebody looked at me and directly or indirectly thanked me for treating them like a human being, like a whole person. That's very sustaining. There's certainly so many people with addiction disorders for whom kindness was so important.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, damn, this is so easy for me to give. This is sinful. When I became more of an administrator and I had less clinical time, I had to find other ways to keep sustained. And that's when I found the joy of actually leading the division. I did not think that I was going to enjoy that as much as I did. But being in the position to be able to improve a work environment for someone, or to help lead them to something that they wanted in their work, to be able to facilitate that somehow, is really exciting.
Yeah. So, you know, I hear about the work you did and the way you talk about it, and I can't help but imagine a 16-year-old in a nursing home who was treating people with respect and kindness and making a difference. Yeah. Jen, I have a closing question.
Okay.
That I ask all the guests. And
okay.
It is, if you could choose one item to put into your doctor's bag, literal or figurative, what would it be?
Okay, well, I have two, actually. So if I had to pick one in my black bag, it's...
You should give us the runner-up.
And okay.
Then I'll let you
well,
say two.
Okay, it's a journal. It's a journal of daily gratitudes. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, write a gratitude. Something you're grateful for. Yeah, I think that we've been talking about that. Like, there's many things that we can be grateful for, right? But you have to identify them. And they are sustaining. And being a clinician of any kind, these days, certainly being a primary care clinician, it takes a lot to sustain. So identifying your daily gratitude, things you're grateful for. And then, but the big thing is find a colleague. Maybe you can find more than one colleague, but find a colleague who helps sustain your hope and optimism.
What is your post-retirement hobby that you do, Jen?
Well, I've returned to watercoloring. I was actually an art major in college, and it's something that I fell by the wayside. But now that I have time, I've returned to it, and I love to watercolor. People call it a difficult medium, but I just think it's just a delight. I have so much fun.
All right, Jen. Great talking to you. See ya. Goodbye.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, bye.